If you're planning to store data on Kate's containers, then it would be smart to explore persistent storage options just to make sure your data is secure and it's going to stay there without breaking. Or sometimes you may just have a simple service running on like a Linux CentOS box or Debian server, and maybe you don't need to containerize it, because sometimes containerizing just creates a lot more complexity or headache that you might not need to deal with. And I can guarantee you don't need to containerize absolutely everything in your environment.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AIOps about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe 29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
Everyone, my guest today is Adam Becker. Adam has a fascinating life story and his way into the IT and DevOps world. He started his IT career working as a classic sort of user desktop and support roles before becoming network and sysadmin, and then later cyber reliability engineer. Today, he works as a DevOps engineer at CGI, a large IT consulting firm many are probably familiar with, where he helps clients set up and manage cloud and container-based infrastructures and services. He also hosts the Hungarian Nerd YouTube channel, where he shares his knowledge about DevOps, Python development, and a few other things. Adam, great to have you on the All Things Ops podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Elias.
All right. Let's get started. Let's get to know you a little bit. I know that you started your working life not in IT, but in a very different job. You were a card dealer at a casino. Are there any skills that you picked up in your time that are still valuable for you today?
Absolutely. At the casino, I met every type of person you can imagine. Drunk and aggressive customers, celebrities, millionaires. One time I dealt poker to Heisenberg and his friends from a show called Breaking Bad. And another night, someone even stole my car and set it on fire because I guess he lost a lot of money. So these days when I'm in IT and someone tells me a client is difficult, you know, I get on the phone with that person and I just use a couple techniques where I try to get on their side and agree with them as much as possible so I can kind of connect and get to their level and see eye to eye with them, where, you know, you got to connect and make them relate, which makes them like me, making them less difficult to deal with. And then they kind of get more onto my side. And, you know, even if they are stubborn and still don't like me, even after I tried and they're still being difficult, well, it still doesn't really get under my skin because at least they're not burning my car down.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you're exposed to many different people and sort of sometimes also in extreme emotions with, you know, they just lost a lot of money or they just won a lot of money. I can imagine how that is. All right, cool. That's an interesting career start. Many of our guests say, you know, that their first encounter with computers, usually at an early age, changed their lives. And most mean that figuratively, but in your case, I think it was quite literally the case. Do you mind expanding on that a little bit?
Yeah, when I was 4 or 5 years old, I used to watch my dad spend an entire weekend installing Windows 95 with like a stack of floppy disks on top of the computer with like a big notepad of like all the little instructions that he had to go through. And he was so frustrated because he always like he would miss a step or one step he didn't do properly. So he'd have to start all over again. And I just remember the frustration. And from there, I think I was maybe 8 years old when I learned how to port forward so my friends could play on my StarCraft server for Zergling Blood. And then at 13, I was hosting my own World of Warcraft private server because my parents didn't want to pay for the subscription, so I could just play with all my friends for free.
Okay, that's an early age to start dabbling in providing services over the internet. Pretty cool. Now, today you work at CGI, which is a large and very prestigious IT consulting firm. What kind of clients do you typically work with? And maybe what's a recent project that you sort of at least can talk about in general terms that's interesting?
Yeah, we have clients from all over the world, all kind of doing different things. And it's kind of hard to say what kind because kind of every kind, I guess. But I could say that right now I'm part of a project where we're doing a massive Zabbix monitoring migration. And Zabbix is a monitoring tool that uses agents to collect all sorts of different data from servers. And you can use these with like Prometheus nodes for them to export the data back to Grafana IDP, where you can kind of visualize everything that's happening in the environment.
Yeah, you mentioned this large scale monitoring monitoring migration in our last conversation. What are some of the more interesting challenges that you're encountering in this project?
So many Excel spreadsheets and so many meeting and so many Word documents and things to keep track of. And, you know, I think, I don't know if you're a gamer, but Serious Sam is a video game and he says, never underestimate the power of stupid things in small numbers. And you would think that a couple Excel spreadsheets won't overwhelm you, but when you have like 100 different spreadsheets with different servers and different things on it, it's just like, and someone in the meeting is, the meeting is like 2 hours long and someone goes, Adam, what about this spreadsheet on this migration? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. And then I'm just like going through all my file explorer folders and there's just so many. And it's a big challenge to keep track of everything. And that's organization is the biggest key to success here.
It sounds a bit like one of those projects where you start with a relatively simple goal in mind. So let's upgrade our monitoring system to the latest version, and which then sort of sets off a chain of events that in the end leaves no stone unturned. Is that the case on this project?
Oh, yeah. Every server we migrate has a different Zabbix template, different macros, different items and triggers, different scripts with different languages. So, you know, one might have a custom template with like a Perl script running something on it, and another one a PHP script, another one a Ruby script. And some of them might be like old Red Hat version 3s that don't cooperate properly. And some of them might not even be in the database because they're just so old. And then, you know, sometimes it's not even just as simple as automating the migration with an Ansible playbook because, you know, every server is different. They're all monitoring different things. So we have to go through thousands of servers and make sure that we know every detail of every server so that after we migrate it, we can verify that all of those things that were working before are still working after the migration. So, you know, in order to do that, we have to do trial migrations where we have to test out our strategies on non-production servers first, so that we can make sure that's the time you can mess stuff up. Because if you start messing stuff up when we go to the production servers, then we can't get away with that without consequences, because then we're messing up with client servers and that can lose their customers and cash flow and business flows. And, you know, that could be a huge impact on our business too. So, you know, going to the production is very stressful because we made all our mistakes in non-prod and now we have to make sure that we're not going to make those mistakes. But sometimes in prod, the servers are different too. So then you didn't really do that practice on the non-prod servers. So, you know, very careful.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously that I imagine that this is quite sometimes a dicey task. One thing that I'm taking away from what you just described is that especially when it comes to these large scale infrastructures, even if you're not automating everything from the start, because it's sort of, you know, growing, probably a good place to start with is sort of, I might need to automate this at some point. Would you agree? What are maybe some lessons learned around automation and automatability, for lack of a better word, that you've taken away from these projects?
Yeah, automation is a blessing that we should use as cautiously as possible, because in the Zabbix world, automation is a lifesaver when you're installing, restarting, configuring, or pushing changes to agents and servers, because then you don't have to go into each server one by one and run out the list of things you have to do. So instead of going and doing that, you could just write a script and push out those commands in that sequence, or you can create a job in Blade Logic, or you can use an Ansible playbooks, or you can use Terraform provisioning, or but you know, in production, you have to be really careful of what you're automating, because if you run an automation job and you didn't specify a certain value, or you had a typo, or just something wasn't specifically right, then you can destroy the entire company, because if you push out that automation, it can like start hitting everything. And then, yeah, so it's important to like check everything, double check, triple check, even like check four times if you have to, and do some trial runs. And of course, you have tools like Jenkins where you can roll back the changes in production, but you don't want to rely on Jenkins. Jenkins got to be like a safety net, I think. But Carla Geyser from Google said that if a human operator needs to touch your system during normal operations, then you have a bug. And the definition of normal changes as your systems grow. And, you know, Google talks a lot about this thing called toil when referring to what should generally be automated. You could look that up, toil, on Google.
Or you can explain it to me and to us. What does it mean? Okay. What is the secret behind it?
Yeah, so toil is kind of like things that are like tasks in your company that could be automated.
Okay.
And those things could be, it's not always grunt work. So like, it's not the tedious task, because sometimes grunt work could be very important. And that could be, I'm trying to think of a topic and example. I mean, like automating should be automated, or not automating, monitoring should be automated, kind of thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Like rolling out monitoring agents and these kind of things.
Yeah. Or provisioning a new environment.
All right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, we're a monitoring vendor as well. We sometimes tend to run into the vendor you just mentioned. And yes, so we're, you know, much of what our enterprise version sets apart from the open source version is around exactly that, about automating at a large scale, agent provisioning, agent updates, these kind of things. But maybe we can have a separate conversation on that. You also mentioned that in the process of this project, you're containerizing parts of the infrastructure that previously weren't running in a container infrastructure. I know from your YouTube channel that you're a big fan, and also some of your posts on LinkedIn, that you're a big fan of Kubernetes. But I think the last time we talked, you also mentioned that Kubernetes should not be sort of the default answer to every question about infrastructure. What might be a more nuanced answer when it comes to containerization, Kubernetes?
Yeah, so Kubernetes was brought in by Google, like Borg, and it enabled companies to move more quickly and enabled like scalability. You can containerize CI/CD pipelines and use like trunk-based deployment strategy to start pushing out new app changes, create new features and softwares and application, and have them push out new availabilities multiple times a day. So, you know, it's a great thing for the new corporate enterprise, but you don't need to containerize everything in your environment. If you have any type of service working with stateful data sets, then unless you specifically set up your Kates clusters to work with stateful data, then Kates will most likely corrupt your data. And when you're using stateful migrations, upgrading, moves, or backups, the safest way is to just not use Kubernetes to make sure your data isn't getting corrupted. And if you're planning to store data on Kates containers, then it would be smart to explore persistent storage options just to make sure your data is secure and it's going to stay there without breaking. Or sometimes you may just have a simple service running on like a Linux CentOS box or Debian server, and maybe you don't need to containerize it, because sometimes containerizing just creates a lot more complexity or headache that you might not need to deal with. And I can guarantee you don't need to containerize absolutely everything in your environment. You can containerize proxies for network troubleshooting, like a busy box container is great, or containerizing your Nginx server or a Gluster Arbiter or buying DNS servers can actually be really beneficial to network security. But yeah, those are kind of the pros and cons.
Containerize everything. Okay, yeah. Got it. You mentioned networking. Let's focus on that for a little while. So I saw that you have like a whole bunch of Cisco networking certifications. I also know from our previous talk that you're actually not particularly into networking per se. Nevertheless, I mean, you do spend a lot of time in learning these things and passing these certifications. Why do you do that?
I regret to say this, but I think networking is one of the most boring subjects to study in IT. But cybersecurity is so exciting because, you know, you hear about spies and crimes and people robbing banks and stuff. And DevOps is pretty fun because there's so many different technologies that are hyped up and involves microservices. So when you're doing labs, you end up doing one lab with 10 different technologies, and it's exciting to see how it all fits together and works. But in networking, you're just kind of staring at routing tables and MAC address tables and trying to figure out why your BGP advertisements aren't working and ripping out your hair because you've looked at the running config tables 10 times before noticing the typo that you entered into the subnet. And, you know, lately I actually shaved my head, so I have no more hair to rip out. I just smacked my head.
Tell me about it.
But actually, I've been really heavily focused on studying programming and coding. So maybe 3 or 5 years from now, I want to be a software engineer. But, you know, networking is just the backbone with everything. So I think that if I get good at networking, then that skill translates over to whatever else I do in IT.
All right. Great. Yeah. I mean, it's the foundational layer that sort of binds everything together quite literally. So I understand why it's good to have a good understanding of these things.
Yeah. Now, I think
we're nearing sort of the end of the deep dives in our conversation. And towards the end, we always ask these little tongue-in-cheek rapid fire questions. And you already partly answered the first one. You said, you know, how old you were when you first started sort of being exposed to computers, at least. I said that 4 years watching dad install Windows 95 on floppy disks. But how old were you when you broke your first computer, or broke the first computer? Hopefully it was probably not yours.
12. I downloaded stuff off LimeWire.
Okay, and that broke your computer.
Yep.
Okay, so the stuff you downloaded was probably not what you thought you would have.
I downloaded a song, an Eminem song, and it was a video. And the video was explicit, and it had a virus on it.
Oh, yeah. Yay. That day, you also learned about the importance of backups of your data, I assume.
And I learned that song files are supposed to be .mp3 and not .zip.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, a lesson learned the hard way. Right. Now, today, I mean, you're working with a lot of different technologies, you know, and you mentioned Zabbix, which is an open source product. You mentioned Prometheus earlier, also open source product. If it comes down to it, I know that most people don't choose, but they use a mix of everything. But are you more of an open source person, or do you like, you know, neatly packaged closed source software?
I like closed source because if I had the option to edit open source, I don't know what I would change about it. So no, if I was a software engineer and really understood more of like the structure of operating systems or softwares, maybe open source would be cool because I can modify it, but I don't know enough yet to decide. Closed source is easier to use for me.
Yeah. Emphasis on yet. That might change if you pursue, you know, your programming ambitions.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to operating systems, you know, holy wars have been fought about this. But are you a Linux, a Mac, or a Windows person?
Windows for personal use, Linux for work.
All right. Good. I mean, that right now, it seems like you're working very much on a sort of on-prem environment. But again, if you had to choose, you know, are you more of a cloud or an on-prem guy?
On-prem. Better to keep track of everything. You know, how much wattage is, you can see everything in this infrastructure.
Okay, good. And I suspect that I know the answer that you'd give today, and maybe also know the answer of future you, but is it coding or configuring?
Coding. I've been learning with Terraform. It's easier to go to the YAML files and edit everything than actually going into the cloud GUI on Amazon and just going through every little option and stuff. It's better to just go to the code and it's faster, I think.
Okay, cool. Good. Is there anything, I mean, that you're I think one of the recurring themes in your career is, you know, always learning new stuff. Is there somebody you'd really like to hear on this podcast that we should invite, where you think it would be great to learn a ton from? Does anybody come to mind?
Yeah, actually, my friend from Chicago flew out here 2 days ago. His name is Nick Astorizaga. We've been studying together since 2018, and I helped him land his first cloud engineer job a couple of years ago. And he helps me whenever I have questions about how to set up Amazon blob storage containers or anything.
Right. Well, we can, maybe you can connect us, and then we can see if we have a conversation similar to ours. You can, if you want to, you can directly address our audience. Anything people can help you with that you're interested in, that you want to learn more about.
Yeah, I'm still very new to IT and DevOps world. So if I said anything that's wrong, or if you have any advice for me, or if you need help with anything and maybe you want advice from me, then please don't hesitate to reach out. I'm open to any sort of feedback or conversation.
Very cool. And, you know, speaking of reaching out, where's the best way to get in touch with you? Is it your YouTube channel? Is it LinkedIn? What's a good way?
Yeah, so my YouTube is Hungarian Nerd. LinkedIn is Adam Martin Becke. My Discord is Barenzia, and GitHub, I have that on my LinkedIn as well, just Becke at GitHub.
Okay, cool. We'll link to all of those in the show notes, so that people can get in touch directly from their podcast player or from the podcast site if they want to. Adam, this has been fun. Quite a few interesting things. I really feel what you're going through with the large scale monitoring migration. You know, being a monitoring vendor, we are exposed to a few of those as well every once in a while. And yeah, I know that these projects tend to sometimes turn into like a spaghetti maze of things that need fixing or that turn out and where you see, okay, we could fix that and we should fix that and so on. And something that started as a 2-month project suddenly is a 2-year endeavor. I can relate to that. Well, best of luck for that project and for all the future projects. And thanks for this.
Thank you, Elias. This was such a pleasure and such a surprise that you just reached out to me one day on LinkedIn and asked me if I wanted to talk on a podcast. And that's just so exciting because I listen to podcasts all the time. And thank you for that. That's so cool.
All right.
Thank you so much. Great. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe 29, the CheckMK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.